This week in Retronauts, you've got to be cruel to be kind. Cruel is the villain from Zool. Retronauties, and welcome to another episode of Retronauts, presented this time by me, Stuart Gipp. This is my third episode as presenter, and as I said last episode, I think you'll agree that this is going to be the best one ever. That's my plan, that's my general goal here, is every single time I host, I want it to build on the previous best episode, which of course was always going to be the previous time that I hosted. I think that's fairly basic stuff. I think that's what we all should be striving for. And if we're not, what are we doing here? You know, today's episode, I am joined by, I'm trying to think of a good way to do an intro here, an host of Sonic the Comic, the podcast, and a music doing man. And I would say general internet producer of amusement. Is that, do you think that's any good?
Having difficulty saying what I do, and that is an experience that I experience.
I'm trying to categorize it well. Well, anyway, it's Dave Thorne. Hello, Dave.
Hello. I'm someone from the internet, and when I think of something interesting, I do that.
I am, yes, that is what you do. That would be a good start if you would like to tell us about the things that you do and have done and are planning on doing in the future, perhaps.
Oh, right. Oh, flipping heck. Okay, where would I see myself in 5 years, you mean?
Let's pretend this is a job interview and you've just been asked that stupid question.
Right. I'm not going to pretend that, because I would have to come up with some nonsense to pretend that I'm a grown-up. At the moment, I'm most known for a podcast, as just mentioned, Sonic the Comic, the podcast, where there's a lot of people, and I'm a big fan of this podcast, but it is quite American. And a lot of sort of American game nostalgia people don't know that everything that they know about Sonic the Hedgehog is sort of a retcon, and that it had a very different life originally and story behind it. And me and my associate Chris McFeely from off of Transformers the Basics on YouTube analyzed that by covering issue by issue the old British Sonic comics that came out, which were the best ones and were very different from what a lot of people think they might have been. And also we do lots of sort of general context, but let's face it, barefaced nostalgia for what it was like to be a child at that time. And that's why I'm here. I'm here in that capacity as a sort of remembering what things were like in the 90s correspondent.
Indeed. Well, I saw you stream the Zool remake, Zool Redimensioned.
Yes.
And I thought, hello, a man who knows things about Zool and or has memories about Zool. And therefore, this has happened. This has all led to this.
Not only do I have memories of Zool, but I have memories of Zool from the UK, which is where you have to have been to have proper memories of Zool. No offense, but if an American starts telling you memories about Zool, they're wrong. Just like with Sonic, although with Sonic, you have to at least sort of, you know, massage their egos about it and say, like, well, you're right in a different way, but they're wrong. But with Zool, you can just straight, and it's like Dizzy. You can just say, like, well, that's very nice, but I'm from the UK, so let me just step in there. And that's what I'm here to do, just to help out. I mean, you're in the same situation as I am, but now you've got backup.
I'm in a similar situation, and finally there is a gun to my side, basically. You are a gun.
Right.
Zool, that's what we're talking about. Zool, Zool, he is a ninja from the nth dimension, categorically not an ant.
No.
This is an idea that was falsely put out there by games magazines who weren't paying attention, and I actually have this from the horse's mouth, so to speak, when I did interview Ian Stewart. That's going to be on the back of one of the founders of Gremlin Graphics, and that's going to be on the back of this episode.
That was always fairly clear to me. I liken it to the fact that I am on my podcast, we covered a sticker album that came out around the time of Sonic 3's release. We did a read through of a sticker album. And we did, what can I say? And in it, this is when Sonic 3 came out, and they described Knuckles as a, quote, monkey-like creature. That is why Zool is an ant. It's because people who don't actually know what the thing is they're covering are still having to just make it up.
In their defense,
yeah,
what's a ninja from the nth dimension exactly? I mean, it's some sort of alien. To be fair, that's there's not much of a frame of reference. You look at Zool and you think, if you didn't know what Zool was and you had to give him a species.
If you had to give him a species and you were affected by the fact that Sonic had made there be lots of animal mascot copycat type characters. Yes, you might, and the fact that Zool is there to essentially copy Sonic.
Yes, he is.
Although I maintain it isn't a copy of Sonic, as some people think. They misinterpret that, but it was there as a sort of Sonic-busting mascot-type creation. You're affected by that. You think, well, it must be an animal. I guess that's an because it's got a black segmented body.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's not a flipping horse, is it? I mean,
it's not a flipping horse. No.
Had he been a horse, this would be very different. We may be talking about a much larger reaching and more successful.
Far better game, yeah. So, yeah, Zool the massive horse.
Yeah. Oh, boy. And at the beginning, you can choose to either have music or clopping sound effects.
Yeah. That's all you now, get. Is that clopping in the internet parlance?
No, or? God, no. Right, damn right. It. I hate that I know what that means and that you said it. There's no element of this that I don't
know. Oh, that's true. I've already dragged this down into the I don't live in the gutter. I'm usually quite highbrow.
I mean, I would wager there probably... Oh, no, I was about to say there probably isn't that much Zool pornography, but there probably is. Let's just move on.
No, Zool. Let's not move on. Let's not move on. I've drawn Zool pornography.
Dave...
And my geography teacher saw it. And she thought it was funny and cool. She laughed and went, that's very good.
For God's sake.
Because it was, what it was a sex scene between, obviously, Zool and Zeus, more on whom later.
Of course.
But it was amusingly covered up by a big thing that was like, you know, censored, we won't print this muck around here, Ed. Even though it was just a drawing I'd done in an exercise book.
I mean, obviously everyone wants to see it.
Don't they?
But, God, I think the podcast has already peaked. It's only all downhill from here. Okay, Zool.
Zool certainly has.
Whoa, hello. The Ninja from the Nth Dimension was originally made for the Commodore Amiga, the beloved little box of joy, the Amiga, by Gremlin Graphics back in 1992.
The best computer that there's ever been.
I'm not going to challenge that because that would lead to a road that none of us want to walk down. But then following the Amiga version, it was ported to lots and lots of other systems.
Inferior
systems, fair play. The Amiga original has the usual, as referenced earlier, it has the whole, do you want to have music or sound effects choice at the beginning, which is something that I have unfortunately never quite been on board with, because why would you not choose the music, you know?
Well, it's something that I struggle with myself, because both options are very good in that game.
It's true.
Really, the only thing you can do, and this is something I genuinely, and I was thinking about this only today, intend to do, anytime I play Zool from now on, it will be with the music playing on YouTube in the background and the sound effects selected.
That's very clever.
There you've got it all then.
Alternatively, you could play the Acorn Archimedes or the Amiga CD32 versions, which allow you to have both.
Well, yes, but I can't imagine the music is correct in either.
I'd be surprised if the Archimedes version didn't have more or less the same music.
Oh, did they tend to do that?
They did, because I had Lemmings on my... I had an Archimedes for some reason. I don't even know how I got it.
Oh, you odd.
I had an Acorn Archimedes and I had Lemmings on it, and it was the same as the Amiga version.
I had a friend who had an Archimedes, and when he told us, it was... The reaction from everyone was pure incredulity and mockery. Not because, understand, we had anything against the Archimedes as a system.
No.
But because we thought he'd just made it up.
Yeah, well, it sounds made up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But I have an Acorn Archimedes. Shut up.
Well, he didn't say Acorn. He just said Archimedes. So it was, it's like saying, oh, yeah, no, I've, like, we were talking about computers. And he was like, well, of course, I've got a Sophocles.
I've got an HP Pythagoras.
Yeah, you're just saying words you think sound clever now. And then when we went around there and he had it, he really had this computer. Somehow the mockery only increased. because he was like, no, look, here's what it does. I can make a picture of Big Ben come up and go bong. You know, oh, can you? Oh, well done. Brilliant.
Yeah, it's sort of, yeah, I've got an Archimedes at home. No, you don't. It runs a operating system called RISC-OS. No, it doesn't.
Mm.
That's obviously untrue.
Mm.
It's got Mad Professor Moriarty on it. That also sounds fake.
He had something where there were little rats running around or something. And, well, whatever. The thing is, this is the only thing I will ever allow to be said against the guy. He was a great guy, brilliant friend. He was great.
Had an Archimedes.
But this one, he had this
and was
one
therefore
black mark against
a stud. A boffin. It's a school computer. It's a computer that we had at school.
Oh, is it?
Acorn Archimedes. Yeah, it's like the BBC Micro, you know. Oh, yes. This was a machine that was essentially aimed at education. you could play games based on the look and read serial Geordie Racer.
Yeah, you know, if you weren't cool enough to play through the Dragon's Eye, obviously.
Yeah, obviously. And, you know, Granny's Garden. And, you know, let's face it, you don't know what that is, but that's not a mark against you, because most British people still don't know what that is.
No, do no. They? No, exactly. Who's read Stick of the Dump all the way through? Don't know. But we've played the BBC version at school.
Yeah, exactly. We've played, and on Archimedes, you could play the game where you talk to the little lad in the Blitz. To the little lad in the war, in World War II, you can say, hello, little lad in World War II. How is it going? Not great. There's bombs and people are getting shot up. And honestly, it's a trial. It's a real trial. Let's hope it all ends soon.
Yeah, how's it going for you? Oh, is it still an hour till lunchtime? Oh, no. Oh, boo-hoo. Yeah.
Any bombs?
He really used to have a go at you, didn't he, that little lad?
Yeah, he's like, oh, yeah, so I see you're upset because you've been packed like peanut butter sandwiches instead of Marmite sandwiches, yeah?
Yeah.
My house just got, like, flattened by a big bomb.
Yeah.
It's not exactly comparable, is it? I mean, it's just, the fact you're even talking to me is a bit of an imposition, quite frankly.
I should be fleeing.
I've got things to do. And, you know, if we've got this power to reach across time, maybe you could go ahead and, like, you know, yank us all out of this hell. Zool. Zool, also on the Archimedes, and Amiga CD32, as mentioned. That's the only way to get both sound effects and music, unless you're playing one of the console versions. But if you're playing the console versions, what you're getting is a completely different game.
Yeah, as we discovered, didn't we?
Well, yes, because I was under the apprehension, the misapprehension, indeed, that kind of apprehension, that the remake, Zool Redimensioned, was based solely on the Amiga version. But
why wouldn't it be?
Why wouldn't it be? Exactly. But then, no, I found out this way that the Mega Drive, SNES, etc. versions of Zool are entirely different in their level layouts. I think the basic gameplay is more or less the same.
More or less, yeah.
There might be maybe slightly less momentum or slightly more momentum.
Well, there's a key difference, which is that they're optimized for controller use. So you can see why that would be the one that they went.
Yeah, absolutely.
Zool is 100% a joystick game, and that's why I actually haven't played it since the Amiga, because I don't have the ability to plug a joystick into my computers.
Exactly. And if you're not tilting up to jump, then what are you doing? You know?
What are you doing? Yeah. Exactly. And by the way, digression, but I won't hear anything against that. There's a lot of fun is made by the sort of unusual people who were raised on the NES. I tried to say that in a comedy disparaging tone, but I think I went too far.
It came off as real hate.
Yeah, I love the NES. But if you were raised on that, then like a lot of people don't understand the up to jump thing and think it's inherently bad. Hey, it was, however, inherently good.
Mm.
It's very tactile. Like, it's a better representation physically of what you're asking the character to do than pressing a button is. Because pressing a button is like, it's like you're controlling a machine or a robot. Whereas with a joystick, you're that way, this way, you're tilting him, you're flicking him up.
Yeah.
You jump and he jumps. It feels like the same thing.
Yeah. And honestly, Dave, I need you to stop talking about flicking Zool up, because this is getting out of control.
Okay. Well, it's just my geography teacher was very impressed.
Well, good for bully for them. Bully for them. But I see what you mean. It's almost like you are physically grabbing hold of Zool and yanking him around. Right?
Yes, and that's how this game was built.
Yes.
Whereas the console version, when that turned out to be the recent remake, it was like, it's not unacceptable. It's just a bit weird. It's what it's a bit like is if they did a remake of, I don't know, Sonic 1, and it turned out to be that weird version that somebody made to run on a NES.
Yes.
Well, that's not that isn't it then.
But I feel like I should talk about what you actually do in Zul to some extent, because I feel like a lot of players will not have even touched Zul with a 10-foot Zul pole.
Yes, you know? We've done too much rambling. Let's actually tell them what we're going to talk about.
What the aim of Zul is, essentially, being a European sort of platformer, and I don't mean that like a dirty word, because that tends to come up quite a lot.
Oh.
You have to collect a certain number of objects before you can leave a stage. Now, my understanding is in the Amiga version, it is just the general collectibles. 100 small candy canes, you know, like that sort of thing. Because this is one of those platformers where, let's say there's just a long line of collectibles, you jump through them, lots of numbers come out and they go bing, 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 bing like that. It's that kind of game. It's a collecting things adventure, which is sneered at, I find, when the game is not just to get from one side of the level to the other. While you do have to do that, you also have to make sure you collect those 100 cakes or whatever, because if you don't get them, you're not going to be able to leave. And to some extent, I can see the like frustration at that, because it is a bit of a hangover from even older microcomputer games like Manic Miner, I think, where you had to collect 10 items in order for the exit to open. It's a similar principle, though here, let's say if you needed 200 music CDs, there would be like 600 in the level anyway, so it really isn't that much of an imposition to collect.
Yes, I suppose that's... I can see that. I've realized as you're saying this that my memory of Zul 2... Sorry, my memory of Zul 1 is actually a bit hazy, and I don't remember whether you have to collect the number of things or not, but I believe you that you do. The thing is, it's been affected by that remake, and so I've sort of forgotten what was from what... But the thing about this game, as with so many other of these apparently much maligned European thing collecting games, is that the collecting of the things was itself very satisfying. You know, I mean, I challenge anyone who's played a Mario game and didn't feel bothered if they left one coin behind on the screen, which they could have got. It just imagine it as that. Zul in particular, along with, say, James Bond 2 RoboCod, stands out on the Amiga as like one where the little bits and bobs that you're collecting are really Moorish to collect.
Yes.
They look good and you want them and you just want to grab them all.
Well, it's very nice because each level is based on your different sort of theme. Like, they're all very unusual themes. There's not like lava level, ice level. There's none of that.
No.
You've got sweets level, candy level, if you're American. You've got a fun fair level with like a coconut shy and balloons and clown faces. And there's a music based stage, which means you're running on stereo CD players.
That's the best one.
Yes. And there are all the enemies change to be based on whatever theme you're in. And all the items you collect change as well.
Yeah.
So it's not just Sonic where you're collecting coins or rings every level. It's level one, you're collecting small dolly mixtures, you're collecting candy canes, you're collecting cakes, you're collecting jellies. In level two, in the music level, you're collecting CDs, music notes, tapes, all that sort of thing. It's great.
And that was at a time when, to me, the CD was an aspirational product. I didn't have a CD player. So to see all these little CDs lying around with that beautiful rainbow shine on them and gathering them all up, along with little tapes and little guitars and microphones and pairs of headphones, woo. Ooh, lovely.
And you've got enemies that are sort of anthropomorphic drums, and when you when you shoot them, your projectiles bounce off the drums and make a drum noise. How good is that?
Yeah.
Who could not like that, really?
Only a fool.
A fool. We're not talking about fools, we're talking about
Zools.
Yeah. Good episode so far, and a game that may be more familiar to console players is a Call Spot, which came out later. I believe that was 93, and that actually does have a similar feel, in my opinion, because it is a collecting game and it has levels made out of like hardware, like wood blocks, tools, and that is something that comes from Zul, I believe. Now, I don't know whether Call Spot was a UK developed or a European developed game, so I'll have to look into that.
I
would speculate that it was.
Personally. Well, I believe that it was. I think, wasn't it made by the people who also made, what am I thinking of? You know, Shiny. It's a Shiny game, right?
I think it was made by Dave Perry, yes, the Earthworm Jim fellow.
Now, was he British or not?
I don't know. His name is Dave, which suggests maybe yes.
Do they not have those in America?
I don't think they have them. Let's look at yourself, for God's sake. You're living proof.
No, quite. I'm living, in a sense, I'm living proof of part of what you're saying, yes.
Theoretically.
Half of the point that you're making.
But I don't know. I mean, based solely on what I understand about the different level design philosophies and game design philosophies of platform games based in both the UK and in America, I would argue that CoolSpot has, if it's not made by a UK team, it's got that DNA in it.
Because Dave Perry is from Northern Ireland.
There we go.
So, yes, his whole thing would have all been about Amigas and Speckies and all that sort of
thing. Brilliant.
Yeah. We intuited that because his games felt native when we played them.
Yes, because there is a level on CoolSpot where mice throw pieces of cheese at you. That is the most British thing I can imagine.
Yeah, and even though one of his games is Disney's Aladdin.
Yes,
like nevertheless, but you know what I mean. Nevertheless,
no, I get it. I was actually this is relevant. I was playing Disney's Aladdin, the Mega Drive game, the other day, and I was thinking, there are a lot of odd little things in this game that make it seem British.
Yes.
Like the fact that when you throw an apple at the guards, their trousers fall down.
Or the fact that it was a really good game.
The fact that you can make Aladdin put Mickey ears on. Mm-hmm. And then a one-up appears and it goes, bleh.
Yeah, the fact that one of the sound effects is bleh.
The fact that in the background of the second level, there are tents that have the sort of gendered male and female toilet signs on them.
And then one for genies.
See, that's us, man. That's what we are bringing to the table.
Yeah.
Right here.
Toilety poo.
Toilet humor, pants falling down, and bleh. Yes.
And books.
So Zool, critique of Zool, really.
It's got any of Pooh's, Wee's, or Six in Zool?
I don't know, but to be fair, it may have buried secrets because there are a lot of sort of hidden levels and extra little bits and bobs. There is a shmup level, as people tend to say these days, I believe.
I think they do, yes.
A shoot 'em up level, a space shooter level, where you are horizontally flying in Zool's ship and blasting baddens.
Well, and furthermore, I remember at the time the legend was that level was set inside Zool's body.
Yes.
And it's all body stuff in there.
That's a very unusual digression to the game, in my opinion.
Yes. Nothing in the rest of the game is anything like that in any regard.
And I believe that's one of the ones you can unlock by playing the piano in the music stage, which is wonderful. I love secrets
like that. Well, the one that I knew was that there was just... This is how we discovered, in fact, that I was not remembering the layout of the level because it was a game I'd never played.
Yes.
Is because there was just a certain corner that if you jumped onto it and you'd go into this level, you didn't have to do anything at all other than that. And that was the only one I knew, so I didn't know about the tune you can play or anything.
No, I found a few of the secret levels in the remake, but I have not found any of them in the original, despite having now played the original quite a bit. And I would like to get back to it as well, because I liked it. Right. What the original Amiga version has that the console version doesn't have, in my humble opinion, is it feels handcrafted. It feels like a guy made it.
Yeah.
Because the level design isn't extremely polished. It isn't uniform. It's not careful. It's just like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if this happened now?
Yes, no, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
Whereas I go the other way. Zool is a game where cool stuff happens.
Yes.
Zool on the console is like a committee polished version of the concept that
I agree, yes.
Personality.
That is exactly how I feel about it. And I don't think that Mega Drive Zool is a bad game per se. I just don't think it's as interesting at all.
No, quite. It's not. Yeah. It's a perfectly good game. And I have nothing against the remake other than the fact that it's of another game.
Yeah. It might be worth mentioning before we talk about the tie-in to this game.
Yeah.
It might be worth mentioning the Chupa Chup connection.
Oh, got to.
Now, I thought they were called Chupa Chups until they did the interview. But apparently, no, they are called Chupa Chups.
Are you sure? Because the reason I think they're called Chupa Chups is I remember Chupa Chups, sweet friend, which was an advert where presumably they say the brand more or less correctly.
You would imagine so, yes.
Maybe, but then it's possible that I was myself imposing that pronunciation and he actually says Chupa Chups, sweet friend.
If anyone knows how you pronounce Chupa Chups / Chupa Chups, please get in touch.
Yeah.
And let us know, because it's now up in the air. I was corrected thusly in the interview section, but now it's been thrown into disarray.
Yeah, sorry. No, we have to go with the person who's, I mean,
We'll go with Chupa Chups for the time being.
Yeah. I mean, that person's older than me, for one thing.
I mean, Chupa Chups to me, I believe they are a European sort of thing, and Chup sounds more European than Chup, I think.
Yes, I think it's, yes, is it a sort of chewing, sucking noise?
Where I think it could well be. I don't know. All I know is there was a lot of them in Zool. There's a lot of Chupa Chups logos, breakable Chupa Chups logos that have things in them. I think that might be in just Zool 2, actually.
Mm.
And, you know, maybe it was...
Sorry, wait a minute. Sorry. Yes. Did you just try and say that the Chupa Chups were only in Zool 2?
No, I said that the breakable boxes okay. that were their logo are,
got it,
are
got
the
it,
ones
got it.
That are in Zool 2.
But okay, good. We were going to no, have a battle.
There was going to have to be a real word fight there.
Yeah.
But no, it's not necessary because I know for a fact they're in both versions. Yes, it's obviously. Fine.
I'm not sure if they were... It would be a really weird thing to say. Like, I would more expect someone to say that they were only in the first one because nobody knows anything about the second one.
Yeah, nobody even has played the second one. It doesn't
No, I'm the only person, and that's why I'm here, really. But we'll get to that later.
We will. I was doing some of my research for this, and this was mentioned on Wikipedia, so it might not be true. But it said that Zool 2 on the Jaguar sold 11,000 copies, and I was like, I don't know if that's a lot or a little for the Jaguar, because I don't know who owned a Jaguar.
No, I don't know, and I couldn't compare that to Amiga sales. Nothing, no idea.
Mm. But I just thought it was interesting to note that specific sort of amount, you know, 11,000 people, and it gets me thinking, like, is that a shitload or is that not none?
Yeah, like, what they've done there is they've somewhere they've found out the information and they've gone, "Ooh, I had better add that to the Wikipedia." Type. And
Needed.
They may not know themselves what it means.
No.
Nobody on Wikipedia knows what things mean. They only know facts.
No, I was out at the pub quite recently and there was like a meetup happening with an internet community that I'm part of.
Yeah.
And on the opposite table to us, there was a Wikipedia meetup happening. And I was quite refreshed.
Wikipedia.
And I began heckling them with vandalism I had done to Wikipedia.
Here's what you should do if that ever happens again. While they're there, you should be secretly vandalizing the entry for their group on Wikipedia.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Oh, God.
While their backs are turned.
They were all very, very kind about it, though, because I was very jovial in my... him saying, yes, the So Solid crew did gain lots of extra members, didn't it? For quite a long time. That's enough of that because there's nothing to do with Zool whatsoever.
Right.
I think that's about all that can be said, honestly, about the original Zool, because as much as it is a fun, fast-paced, action-packed, climbing, shooting... What is he throwing? Jelly beans?
I don't know. He's just shooting little dots.
Because I always thought they were jelly beans because of the sweet environment, you know, because when I didn't actually... in fact, that's a question I'd like to raise. How did you first come to play Zool? Like,
okay,
how did you become aware of the existence of this man, Zool?
Yes, I will tell you exactly how. I was about 10, and this was about 1992.
Yeah.
And at that time, something that people who are interested in nostalgia gaming but wasn't necessarily there don't always appreciate is that back in those days, I only mean the UK here, didn't quite have the like release day culture that we have now. So when something comes out, if you don't have it within, I don't know, 4 years, it hasn't necessarily gone away and it's still fine to want and to get the thing then. Mm. I got my Mega Drive in 1994 and that didn't seem to me like I'd missed a boat at all, even though the PlayStation was coming out. Like, that was just kind of how things were. So the situation I was in 1992 was that like my entire gaming situation at home was ZX Spectrum. That was it.
Mm.
An early 80s machine. And then my friends who had anything at home, you know, I had one Mega Drive friend.
Yes.
Mostly people just had ZX Spectrums. That's kind of where we were. It was very rare to have anything more. And into that environment, my best friend at the time, whose computer up till then had been whichever one it was that, you know, sort of old people used to have, where it was either a green or an orange screen,
yes,
with a floppy disk slot in the side of the screen, but for the really big floppies.
I see. It was for doing sums on.
You do sums on them, you do word processing, and he had like two games, one of which was a sequel to Tau Ceti, which I had on the Spectrum, and one of which was Samantha Fox's Strip Poker.
I see.
And I had another friend who had that. That was his computer as well. Like, this was what the environment was like. Gaming was a very dull monochrome thing. And then this guy got an Amiga 1200 as well.
Oh my God.
A good one.
AGA.
Yes, and I don't, that was a graphical chipset that made it look better. And I don't know why this happened. I don't know what whimsy his dad got in his mind to buy a new computer for the family. But suddenly, what my friend had was like, just a miracle.
Mm.
Just something that could create magic and miracles. And he had Zool, because it came with Zool, because they all did. That was the point of Zool, was to be the thing you had on the Amiga. And so I went around there and played on it and just couldn't believe any of the senses that my body was telling me I was experiencing. Like, the speed of it, the look of it, the music, which is that's the part you can still sort of experience today. You know what I mean? Everything else is compromised because we don't have CRT.
Oh, there's going to be Zool music interspersed throughout this podcast.
Of course there is. Of course there is. But yeah, just to go from beep, 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 blurb. And by the way, there is some beautiful music made on the AY chip over on the Spectrum. That, you know, I've done it down by saying beep, blurb. But that was the genius of it, was that it was all constructed out of that.
Yes.
And you know, same on things like the NES, really, although we didn't. Did we have that yet? Yes, I think this same friend may have had one of those by this time.
I had one NES friend. One NES friend.
He was my one NES friend, yeah. Mm. It's just a question of what came first. Well, yeah, when he got his Amiga, it was like someone had pushed a symphony orchestra into his house or something. It was an incredible change from what we were used to. Oh,
the quantum, I mean, that said, for context's sake, not obviously your context, yours is very different, but going from the Commodore 64's like SID chip, the SID chip, it's maybe slightly less of a leap. But
yes,
because that was very famed for its music. Sort of
the SID chip was absolutely wonderful, and I was unaware of it, and I didn't have a C64 or a C64.
Yeah, I didn't know it was a thing until like way later anyway.
But it was still a significant difference, because what that was doing was extremely high-level beeps and blurbs.
Mm,
and
yes,
they sound so great, whereas what the Amiga was doing was it was entirely sample-based. So, interestingly, although the first sort of crop of games basically used that sampler to sample C64 bleeps and things, and like there was a lot of games that did that, stuff like Zool was like listening to a keyboard demo. In those days, you used to go into a toy shop or whatever and press the demo key on a keyboard and
just
listen to music.
Then get told off by your mom.
Yeah. Mine was very patient. She would leave me there and use that opportunity to go and shop for something sensible. But this was like that. It was, we hadn't really had a sound like this before, because it was made out of like, oh, here's a sample of an electric guitar going down, and they built music out of that. Here's a flutey sound. Here's a slap bass sound. And here is a sound of a guy going, and then a smashing glass noise.
That's like the first thing you hear in the original Zool is that, and then in the background you've got your, it's great.
It's really cool. But that's the thing. This, and by the way, I should have said this in the intro. This is I am here in my capacity as the one guy who's furious every time he's trying to find a copy of Zoolophobia, which is the title screen music from Zool 1. And everyone on YouTube has uploaded it playing at the wrong speed.
That's unacceptable.
Everyone, because the original .mod file that, you know, that the music was, that it ran from, says in the samples, like there's only one, you could name all of the samples, and only one of them is named, I believe. And it says, change speed to 168 or something like that. It says what number it is. And that is how to play the music properly. If you just play it by itself, it plays too slow. Evidently, something in the game, not in the music module, made it play at that speed.
It doesn't
work.
So there isn't a correct speed version of this song on YouTube at all?
There is, but it's that is showing the title screen. And I will.
Oh, I see. Because I saw a. I mean, I wonder if it's a 50 hertz thing, like a Powell thing.
No,
no, I don't mean that. Yeah. I don't mean that in a bad. I mean,
no,
that,
I know.
As in, it was meant to be like that. Or
I know. Yeah. Well, look, it could be. I mean, who in the 60 hertz region is running an Amiga anyway? So this wouldn't have been something they considered. But no, because that normally sped things up. Whereas. Right. Yeah, no, it's I will make sure that you have a copy of the correct
speech. I'm excited to get Zoolophobia.
Yeah.
This is going
to
be good.
What it's supposed to go like...
Unlike you with your Zoolophilia.
What it's supposed to go like is... Doodle-doodle-doodle. Diddle-doodle-doodle-doodle like that. But what it goes like on YouTube is... Because that's one sample it plays as No, because that's the thing. It just plays. And that's the problem. The samples are all in the wrong. So there's one bit where it goes like bow wow wow bow wow wow bow. And if you play it wrong, it's like bow wow wow. No, I can't do it because it's so wrong. It's like bow wow wow bow wow wow.
Oh, it's
wrong.
Awful.
It's really cut. Never mind. Anyway,
I'll angry
this
now.
Bit, it's rubbish. I'll send you the proper sound.
I hate it. We should talk about Zool 2. We should definitely talk about the sequel to Zool.
Yeah.
The sequel to Zool was developed by a team called the Warp Factory, and it was released in late 1993 for the Amiga, which must make it a fairly late Amiga game in general in terms of its mainstream sort of success.
Right. Well, I won't listen to that kind of blasphemy. Well,
okay. Let me rephrase that. A late game for the Amiga in terms of the ignorant populace ignoring, like, not giving it its dues.
I mean, Worms was the end of 1995.
Really?
Yeah.
It was as late as that.
We can safely say that was a mainstream Amiga release.
I am talking bollocks in that case, and I apologize. I genuinely didn't realize
The thing is, it was... No, what Worms was it was the last... It was the last Amiga game of note, and yes, it probably came out quite a while after most people had stopped being interested in Amiga, and I just have to come to accept that. I do.
Worms even got its director's cut, which is exclusive to the Amiga
until.
And it had many of the features that many people associate with Worms 2 or Armageddon.
I know.
And nobody knows about it.
Most people just write off the Amiga and don't bother learning about it in Amiga history, but that's what we're here to correct.
The Amiga Mini that's coming out in April has got it on it.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm excited about that.
I'm quite excited about that.
The small Amiga.
Yeah, it's a little Amiga.
It's time to think, if it's not been done already, there must be a general Amiga episode of Retronauts. Going to put that one on the old... back burner. Zool 2 was also released again on CD32. It was released on the Atari Jaguar, of all things, and it was released for MS-DOS. I know that because I had the sold-out software version of it, and it didn't work.
Ah!
So I was not able to play it.
Oh, that's a shame.
It's disappointing. The Jaguar version, having looked into it, and I have played the Jaguar version on the emulator a little bit,
right. It
seems to be, I would argue, the most polished of the versions, in that, you know, you can get both music and sound effects. It seems to have the full graphics of the Amiga version and everything.
Fair enough. I can't
and
argue that.
But unfortunately, to play it, you have to either have a Jaguar or emulate the Jaguar, neither of which are easy to do. It also brings back in a major capacity Zool's. I don't want to say this because it sounds kind of... the Zool's sort of female counterpart and or girlfriend and or the girl version of Zool. I don't know what Zool's is. I don't know what her role is. I mean, I know what her role is in your drawing, but let's not dwell on that any further.
There's simply no... Like,
why do you keep bringing it up, Dave?
I know. I'm insatiable. But there's simply no point in not acknowledging what Zool's was there for. We'll make a girl one.
Yes.
Like, Sonic 2 had Tails.
Yes, the girl version of Sonic.
The girl version of Sonic. Yeah. And so Zool 2 needed one. And it just, because, I don't know, maybe this is the era that it was, the done thing maybe had become, all right, well, girl version then, so that it's not just two boys.
Yes.
Maybe that, I don't know why they did it. And I don't know to what extent And it's difficult in related media, about which we'll talk later, to ascertain to what extent Zeus was meant to be an alternative for instance, female players, or was she meant to be a sex pot? It's genuinely difficult to tell which of those things
there was. In-game, my understanding is that she has a different attack. She has a melee attack with her electric whip thing that she has. That's what I have read.
That's right.
And also, apparently, she can take different routes because they're able to each break different parts of the environment.
That may be true. I can't now remember.
I have looked into this extensively, and I can find nothing to back this up.
One of us should have tried playing it.
I have tried playing it. I have extensively searched for different routes through this game. I have even looked at long plays of this game.
Oh, I see.
And I cannot find any evidence that this is true. I'm not saying it's not true.
It sounds a bit like someone, who just is assuming things based on Knuckles.
There is not a lot of information about this game's production out there on the internet. There is basically what in old magazines, which have been scanned like Amiga Action, and there is Wikipedia. And having looked at these Amiga Action scans or whatever that mention this feature, they do so in a preview context. They do not say this about the finished game. So I am not convinced that is true.
Right. That's just something they wanted to do but couldn't.
Yes. I think that may be the case. I can't confirm it, though. So it remains a bit of a Zool mystery. I'm going to keep checking, though, and I will find this, and then we will do a three-hour follow-up episode discussing this alone.
We'll do a follow-up episode where we've actually gone and played the game instead of just relying on nostalgia.
Well, speak for yourself there, Dave, because I have, in fact, played the game. Other than Zeus, it also introduces the two-headed dog, Zoon, who I believe you only play as in a breakout-style minigame.
That is literally the only point of Zoon, I think. Yes, Zoon is a two-headed dog and therefore makes a decent, paddle for a breakout game.
Yeah. And the villain, the big villain of the series is called Krull, K-R-O-O-L. And you don't actually fight Krull, I don't think, in any of the games. You may fight him in the remake.
Krull, as far as I'm aware, has only appeared once, or at least across the two games.
Yes.
And that is in the form of a postcard that came with Zool 2.
Wow. Where
he was depicted simply as a pair of eyes looking out of some sort of ridged meat.
Some ridged meat.
That's my memory of it. It's not very clear. I don't have it to hand.
Because in Redimension, the final boss is a pair of eyes in space, which may be supposed to be Krull.
That'll be that then. But is that in the Mega Drive game or not?
I don't know. I haven't. I don't know. That I didn't check.
I'm going to just quickly go to a Mega Drive long play now while we talk and find out.
Yes, because I need to talk about the actual villain of Zool 2, which is a square.
Yes.
It is a block named Mental Block, which is A, funny, and B, slightly distasteful.
Yeah, it's not the sort of joke we would make now.
No.
In 1993, it was very funny.
It is extremely... Yeah, in 1993, everyone was ringing each other up on their wall-mounted landline phones.
Yes. And talking about how funny and clever it was.
Yo, Dave Meister.
Hey, what's happening, dude?
The Dave Meister.
Yeah.
You hear about Mental Block in Zool 2?
Mm.
It's death. DEF, they used to say that.
Yeah, no, they did. Yeah.
Yeah, it's def, definitive, or definitely very good. I don't know what it actually means.
Oh, is that what def meant? Definitive?
I thought it meant definitive.
Oh, that would be good.
Yeah, it's DEF, definitive.
Mate. I never knew.
No, I didn't know. And then, you would go back up into your bedroom on your Fruit of the Loom jumper. And
that's what you do. No, all I ever knew about it was that dope, def, anyway was okay when your DJ plays the K.
Yeah.
To what the kid has to say.
Now, in terms of gameplay, Zool 2 is not that different to the original Zool, but I would argue it is quite a bit more polished.
So this is the thing. Zool 2 is generally kind of maligned, I find, because people will say of it that no one played it. And I don't know if that's the case or not, but I think that Zool 2 is like the Sonic 3 of Zool. I think it was very polished in all of the ways that matter to a child with an Amiga, which is that it looks better.
Mm-hmm.
And it does. They, Sonic 3 style, they really kind of added a sort of roundiness to the sprites and made them a bit more like they were drawn by cartoonists and illustrators
The Zool sprite in the original game is very deluxe paint looking.
Yes.
It's extremely dumpy. But in Zool 2, he looks a lot more edgy and cool. Like, I think they actually did get a Disney guy in to redesign him.
Really?
I read that somewhere, yes, but I don't remember their name.
Well, now this is this was reflected in the actual physical packaging as well, because the original box for Zool has a drawing of Zool on the front, which was very kind of like a designer did it rather than an illustrator did it.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's
yes.
made out of shapes. And in the manual, there was a comic that illustrated the story behind Zool. Because, of course, in those days, manuals used to have to come with a story.
Yeah,
here's the story so far, because we couldn't have...
And, of course, back then, games used to also come with manuals, which
used to come with manuals.
Yeah.
And because it was a big box game, as we call them now, a game, as we used to call them then. And it came with this manual in which was this comic of Zool. And it was, again, drawn kind of crudely of him landing in Sweetie Land and getting on with his adventure. Well, in the version of Zool that I had, because I got it as I got my Amiga quite late, summer of 93, so too did I get my copy of Zool quite late. And it had box art, redesigned box art and manual comic to be in line with the artist doing the cover for Zool 2, and the comic that I believe came with that as well. So, yeah, it had this design change, although none of the contents of the game, you know, didn't change the title screen or anything like that.
No.
So as he had had an upgrade on the boxes themselves, so too did he have an upgrade in the sprites and other in-game art by the time of Zool 2. Don't know who did it, though. Don't know.
I've been desperately trying to find the name of the fellow who redesigned him, because I had it earlier. I didn't write it down, because, again, extremely clever, borderline genius man.
This is good. We're making a really good case for this more British version of Retronauts, huh?
Yes, I've done what can only be described as a weak... I found it. Okay, there we go. Everything's come up great. He has been redesigned by a man named Alan Barton.
Right.
Who did work on Tiny Toons, Roadrunner, Daffy Duck cartoons, Disney's Jungle Book, Sylvester the Cat, and apparently Batman Returns. He worked on all of those.
And of course, Alan Barton was half of Black Lace, whose hits included Agadoo and Superman. That's true, but it'll be another one.
Or is it? What if it's not? If it's not, we've just cracked the code.
Oh, imagine if Zool was redesigned by one of the guys who made Agadoo. That would make me so happy. I can't even explain.
That's the kind of thing where you'd have to just go and lay down for a bit to recover from the sheer joy.
And we broke that exclusive.
Yeah, that's Redford. Let's just pretend it is. We have really,
I think, now made the case for this more British.
Yeah, Redford is a UK Retronauts exclusive. Alan Barton from Black Lace is responsible for redesign of Zool. If that's incorrect, please don't tell us.
Yeah, never tell us.
We want to remain in this blissful world, but wherein that's true. Mr. Editor, if you'd like to sink in a little bit of Agadoo now, you're very welcome. Agadoo, push pineapple, shake the tree.
Agadoo, the very first record that I owned, because it came on the TV and it had Dancing Pineapples and I was enamored of it. And my dad, who was all, you know, he's into all like prog rock and stuff from the past. And this is just the mark of a good parent. He had to personally trudge off to the shop and queue and openly with his face and everything, because he couldn't do it. You couldn't buy things on the internet in those days. He had to own up to wanting to purchase this record, and he had to do that with his face, with his presence.
With his actual face.
There in the room. But not only that, it was the first record. This is the way he tells it. Agadoo was the first record he ever bought, because... Blimey. He wasn't allowed to have his own records back home. And then by the time he had his own place, he was just sort of into tapes by then. So, I'm sure he had albums, but I think it was probably his first.
It could be
single.
Worse. The first record I bought was Earth Song by Michael Jackson.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. And you know what turned out? He didn't even redesign Zool, so...
I did not so much as...
No. Anyway, moving swiftly on from that man, as good as Zool 2 is, and it is good, it is a good platform game.
Yeah.
I would say it is very similar to the original, just, again, much more polished, more enjoyable way. Yeah. Bigger levels, better level design, lots more fun collectibles, even more collectibles are everywhere.
Oh, it's so Moorish to grab those things.
And you can barely take a step without collecting about six things in that game. It's great.
No, it's great. And this is the thing. This is why I hesitated when you said that it's one of these games where you have to collect a certain number of things. I don't think I've ever got to the end of a level of Zool and had not already just incidentally collected all the things.
Well, it's exactly what you were saying. Why on earth would you not want to collect the things? I mean,
they're all there and I'm running around and collecting them. Yeah.
That's what they're for.
Yeah.
One thing I will say is the final level of this game, which appears to be set in some kind of thoughtscape.
Okay, so this is it's worth mentioning the we've already mentioned the sort of conceptual nature of these levels. Zool 2, I think, took that to another level again. Like it had Zool 1, no, we've already said it wasn't your simple ice level, lava level. It was a bit more sweets level, music level. But in Zool 2, they were even more abstract. The first one was called Swan Lake, I think.
Yes.
Or some pun on Swan Lake.
It was Swan Lake, yes.
Yeah. And so it was just the bird stuff. So there was like, you know, bird feeder things hanging down that you collected. Yeah. And all of the collectibles were like little rubber ducks and worms for on ends of hooks. And there was eggs on mountains in the background.
Yeah. And you could bounce on them. Fried eggs.
Bounce on fried eggs. It was all like that.
Yeah. Rubbery fried eggs.
And Zool 2, oh no, I was about to say something musically about it. I'll say that in a minute because that's a different topic. But yes, the final level was called Mental Blockage.
Ah.
Hence Mental Block.
Yes.
I don't know which one came first, but in the development. But and it was just about cerebral things. So it was like crossword puzzle you're running about in.
Yeah.
There was, you know,
Shakespeare quotes and E equals MC squared.
And there was a head with the brain bit divided up, like one of those phrenologies.
Columns like Greek, like necropolis sort of thing.
Quills to collect and music, because that's cerebral as well. So it was a little bit of music, even though they famously had a fully music level already. And that was the sort of, so it was a lot, it was way more abstract, the levels in Zool 2, and it made them so much more fascinating.
But the thing about that level in particular I really, really want to mention is that I feel like the aesthetic of it is part of what people on the internet now call aesthetic. It is very vaporwavy. Mm. It's got a pink background. It's got big columns everywhere. It's got a big head. It's got like an anatomical model of a human head in there that you can, and it just makes me think about the whole vaporwave thing. And, you know, if only it was slightly out of focus, then we'd be laughing. But, you know, considering the tellies that we had back then, it probably was.
It was. That's the thing. And I was laughing. That's exactly what was happening. I was sitting there going, ah, ha, ha, playing on Zool 2 because I was having such a nice time being, you know, whatever I was, 12 or whatever it was.
It's good.
This is the thing. It good. Like Zool. He runs around. He's really fast. He's skiddy. It was one of the first games I'd played that had that Mario 1 style skidding in it.
Yeah, the momentum.
On a home computer. And in fact, you could turn that off.
Yeah, you can just switch it off if you hate it. Apparently, I read that in an interview with Ant Stream Arcade that Ian Stewart did, that was like a QA, that was a tester's thing saying, like, please let us turn off the momentum.
Really?
Yeah. It was nice of them to, you know, kowtow to those fools.
But of course, that should have been called Ninja of the Nth Dimension Stream, not Ant Stream.
You're absolutely right, yes.
Zool had laser blades that he could pull out of his fists and do a spinny move. That was another thing Zool could do. He could climb walls. I don't think we've said this. He could stick to walls and jump up them. Not climb, but not like Knuckles, but jump.
He could do a sort of a Mega Man X hop, except without sliding down the walls. He was very clever at sticking to walls.
I think in the remake, you can just climb, and maybe that's
maybe
in the Mega Drive version you could.
I'm not sure if that's the case, but you definitely can in the remake. Yeah, they changed it so that you can just climb walls now.
Whereas that was a proper little twitchy joystick thing.
Yes.
On the Amiga. And I'm going back saying anything we didn't say that I think is important. Zool 1 had two versions. It had the Amiga 500 Plus version, which the Amiga most people had, and that just looked normal like a game. And they had the 1200 Plus version.
Yes.
No, 1200 version, which was the AGA chipset, allowed them to do more graphics. So what they did was they put these ridiculous backgrounds in that made the game worse.
Yes, that was very common though with Amiga 1200 games, like the 1200 version of Robocod, as it adds some new levels, but also it adds these ridiculous backgrounds of like huge, fully colored objects that obscure the view.
Yeah, repeat. So in Zool, it's repeat patterns of, you know, CDs and music
and bananas, strawberries.
Okay, back to what you were attempting to talk about, Zool 2.
Yes.
It was good, it felt like a proper modern platformer on the Amiga. It felt like, it just felt completely up to date for what games were at that time, and I've always been a bit bugged by anyone who didn't appreciate it, because it was good, and now,
I love how this podcast is just us screaming, it's good!
It was good! Right, I played through to the end of Zool 2 because I was loving it so much, and that is rare. Not my approach to games was just to, knock them on, play about a little bit, oh, now I want to play this other game, stick that in. I've never had this thing until the current crop of games, where I feel like I should finish a game. And I feel bad if I don't. That wasn't what I did. And yeah, this, Sonic 3 and Knuckles, I don't know, like Yoshi's Island, there were a few, the best games were the ones that I actually bothered to finish. And Zool 2,
yeah,
one of those games.
Yeah.
It was music, right?
Yeah.
So the Zool 1 music, it wasn't even just that you could select music or sound effects. You had something like 5 tunes in the game, and you picked which one you wanted at the start of the game. And that was what you had. So, and they had names like, rock or rave or green.
Green. I love it. That makes me really happy.
People keep explaining what that was a reference to, and I can never remember now.
Was it a reference to Percy from Blackadder 2 and his lump of purest green?
It was not. No, oh, okay. It was like...
It should have been.
Well, there's another... I want to say, there's another musical genre that's a colour, so bluegrass, maybe. Maybe that was what it was. It was like that, and for some reason they just changed the name. I can't remember. There was a reason why it was called Green that someone's explained to me over and over again recently. I know, it'll be Ben Padden.
Oh, Ben Padden of formerly of Ports Center.
Yes. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. Yes.
Yes.
Whereas in Zool 2, they did the more modern thing where each level has its own music. And the music in Zool 2 didn't follow that, do you want what's your musical genre? Do you want rock? Do you want pop? What do you want? No, it was like everything in the UK music in 1993, which I think is when it came out.
It was 93, yes.
Or it was 93.
Very late 93, yeah.
1993 was the best gaming year, and you can quote me on that.
I'm going to quote you on that.
Well, anyway, by then, music in the UK was all just electronic dance anyway. So yes. That's all they did. But they made it really interesting. It's got, for my money, the best, we're doing an Egypt level, so we have to do the obligatory Egypt-sounding music that you're going to find on the Amiga in a competitive field. There's the Lemmings 2 one.
Mm-hmm.
There's
Super Frog.
Oh, now wait a minute. That's the best one.
Yeah, I've validated your point. I'm sorry.
I'm so sorry. What I was even thinking. I apologize, Mr. Brimble. Do forgive me. But yeah, all right. It's the second best one. It might even be the one that stands up the best now because it's got a real good beat to it. But the Super Frog one will have the best tune. But really good. But it was just all strange. There was something odd about all of the tracks. They either did something that was quite interesting sample-wise, or they would play with the speed a little bit, or they would have just odd sound effects going in the background.
The opening, the tune that plays when the game boots can only be described as just farts.
Okay.
But I don't mean that in necessarily a bad way, but there is quite a lot of in it.
There is another way that it can be described. That is as the perfect sequel to Zoolophobia. So Zoolophobia, Zool was it was meant to be a showcase for Amiga gaming. It was meant to be their mascot. And so it was showing off stuff that Amiga could do. And so it did go heavy with the sound effects. It did have Zool going and the smashing noise and the little
many samples, only samples.
And it had this cock crowing sound that was in it as well. That was part of the music, was this cock crow, which was the music would stop, the cock would crow, and then the beat would come back in again.
So the Americans, we're talking about a rooster.
Oh, shut up, Americans. We're not talking to you.
yeah, this isn't for you anymore.
Sorry, Americans. Yes, I meant a rooster. But that was like, look what the Amiga can do. We can put these interesting, funny things in. Well, Zool 2 was just like, right then, right then. Yeah. We know how to do a Pro Tracker these days. We're going to really go to town. And so the title music to Zool 2 is the same tune as in Zool 1, although not Zoolophobia. I think it's the one that played in the levels, which there was a couple of levels had the same tune remix. Yeah. And it was full of all these like whoosh, bang, splat, farty noise, dug-a-dug, you know, rule on the edge of the table. And memorably, there was one really good bit where the music does sort of calm down a little bit. And you hear the rooster. It's like, yay, it's the Zool rooster. And then you hear a man shoot the rooster to death in the second, to my mind, funniest way anyone has ever shot to death a rooster in an audio.
What's the first? I'd like to know.
The first was, and you're going to think I'm joking, but I'm not, on a tape of Mr. Blobby stories.
For God's sake, yeah.
In which there was Mr. Blobby wakes up and, you know, Noel Edmonds goes, Mr. Blobby woke up to the sound of the cock crowing. And there was this cock-a-doodle-doo going on. And then, and it was, as with this, it was someone having fun with a sound desk and a bank of samples, right? Yeah. And Mr. Blobby goes, like, oh, Blobby, Blobby. And then you hear him fire a dart and the cockerel noise, that's what I should have said, cockerel, stops. And is replaced by the sound. And imagine this, but sped up, so it sounds a bit Alvin and the Chipmunks. The sound, ooh, that was the funniest death of a cockerel on any kind of audio thing. However, this one was pretty good, and I invite you to play it.
Beautiful. This episode's turning out like everything I ever hoped for, honestly. It really is. Now, I feel like we've talked about Zool a lot. I think as for the remake, that has been gone into quite extensively in the interview, so I think we should give that a very brief. I mean, I would like to say Zool Redimensioned, which came out earlier this year. It's a remake of the Mega Drive version of Zool. The changes, so to speak, are all quality of life changes, like the way that you, I think the way that you regain health has been changed, so it's easier. You have more health. You can now climb walls, as we discussed. You no longer have to collect items to exit the level in the normal mode. You have to do that in the harder mode. And the view has been zoomed out, which, in my humble opinion, is just a better experience.
Yeah, like, I agree with
now, that. Having said that, very recently, they have patched the game and added the option to have a slightly less zoomed out view and a normal zoomed in view.
Right. Okay.
I made it more like the original optionally.
Okay.
But I don't know why you would do that, because the way that they have done it makes the game so much more playable than it was on the Mega.
Well, yes, it does. But, you know, that's why, because we've already established that, like, you don't have to actually do anything to finish the levels anymore. Like,
not just on normal mode. On Ultimate Ninja mode, you still have to do that, but you also retain the other kind of quality of life things, like the save feature, which I think is nice. I'm happy with that.
Oh, yeah. No problem with that.
And it's nice that they've hidden, like, there are three things, big things in each level that you now can get, and it gets tallied, like you have found all the things. You have par times to beat. You have developer times to beat. All the bosses have been redone.
Sure, yeah.
I would argue it's a very good remake. For purists,
it's a very good remake. Yeah. If what you want to play is the Mega Drive version of Zool, then play Zool Redimensioned.
Yes.
Definitely. If you are nostalgic about the Amiga version, it's weird. The experience I had streaming it with a very hazy memory of Zool and thinking that was what I was playing, because they used the correct music from the Amiga
version. They do.
And that puts me on the wrong foot. I thought that, like, here we go. I wasn't collecting any big polos, and I wasn't, you know, I understood why.
Where are the polos?
Where were they? That was a key thing in Zool. And also the collectibles were, like, you know, a couple of different suites instead of, I now recognize, you know, polos. Like, it felt compromised, but I don't know how much of that is because the Mega Drive version was compromised, you know?
There's also, it's worth noting that Zool Redimension features No Chupa Chups. No Chups.
Well, that's the thing. Of course it doesn't. And I was expecting that, and I was sad about it, but I was expecting it because we've already had a penguinless version of RoboCod.
Yes. You know? Oh, yes. That's...
Now, by the way, when we should have said this before. When we talked about the Chupa Chups
that
are everywhere in Zool 1, or at least... Yes. Certainly in the first level, you know, as the game goes on, it gets hazier in the old memory because I never used to get very far. But there would be lollies to collect. There would be just Chupa Chups logos everywhere, big ones, small ones, big as red. That was just part of the game. That was normal Amiga. That was not unusual, and we didn't think it was any weirder than, like, if you're about to, the Americans get at us about this, right? They go, it's really weird that, we're Americans, and it was really weird. This is how we sound. It was really weird that you had sponsorship in your games. To which I say, I tried to watch some Transformers recently, and the weirdest thing about, like, watching American cartoons in their original format when they're released in that way is that, like, the cartoon will end, and then it'll go, you know, we'll be back after these advertisements. And then it comes back for the end credits.
Yeah.
There's an advert break before the end credits.
It's supposed to come very back. Bizarre.
That's obscene. And
it's an obscenity.
I agree. Okay, it's weird that we had sponsorship in our games, but I'm just saying we're on a fairly even playing field here.
I would agree with that. I mean, with other than Zool and its Chups, there's also, as mentioned, RoboCop with the penguin chocolate bars.
Yes.
James Bond 3 lets you go to a whole penguin world.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And there's also... not one, but two games based on Quavers.
Yep, based on Quavers.
Yeah, Pushover and One Step Beyond.
That's a kind of crisps.
Based on Quavers, which are curly, cheesy crisps presented by the humorous character of Colin Curley.
Yes.
Now, none of this alarms me in any way. I'm just like, game based on crisps, of course.
There's something slightly different about that, because the British gaming world was that if a thing exists, someone would probably make a game out of it. There was a Mr. Blobby game. There was an Ed the Duck game.
Yes.
He was just the hand puppet, not even puppet, hand puppet that used to sit next to the presenter of about 2 hours of children's TV programs in the afternoons after school.
Yes, was he Broom Cupboard, or was he Going Live, or was he?
He was Broom Cupboard.
He was Broom Cupboard, okay.
Because Gordon moved to Going Live to make
shortly before his sad death. Go on.
Sad demise. There was a Chewits game, which was Pac-Man, because the Chewits adverts were a riff on Godzilla.
Yes.
But also King Kong. It was like stop motion animation. And so he was climbing the tower and eating Chewits, and helicopters were coming along. So his game on the Spectrum was helicopters instead of ghosts going after the Chewits monster eating Chewits. Chewits were a small, square, chewy sweet. But I don't remember anything like that until the Amiga. And let us not, there'll be people jumping up and down and shouting, forget Super Frog, which is a... what was it called? What was that drink called?
Lucozade.
I was going 7-Up? No. Sprite? No. Yeah, Lucozade.
But now, that's interesting you mentioned that, because we talked about Cool Spot earlier, and that was also sponsored by 7-Up itself.
But we didn't know that, because this is something that I figured out on my podcast, because we'd been confused about this for years.
Yeah.
Cool Spot, famously, the spot from the 7-Up logo.
Yeah.
This confuses people like us, because we go, was he? I thought he was just from a Mega Drive game that was like one of the main Mega Drive games. Well, turns out he was not in this country a 7-Up character. 7-Up stuff was in fact removed from our version of the game.
Yes.
And it was just a game about a little red spot, and he was a gaming character, and that was who he was. And he had Fido Dido.
Yeah, and he had a game too.
Who had a game? Yeah, of course.
But that's interesting about Cool Spot, because that explains a lot, because, no 7-Up. And also, instead of collecting, when you collect letters in the bonus stage, in our version, they spell out Virgin, which is the name of the company. It's not like having a go at you, the player.
No.
But in the original version, it is the phrase Uncola, which I think is the catchphrase of 7-Up. It's Uncola.
Oh.
Or something like that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, see? Getting to the bottom of this stuff.
I'm so glad
that in there.
I'm so glad that that BS I just spouted out of the top of my head as if it was definitely true about them editing out the 7-Up stuff in the UK version.
No, they did.
It turned out to be true. Good. I thought it was, but I can never trust my own.
There are other sponsored American games as well, like Chex Quest, for example. But
right, but again, yeah, Mick and Mac Global Gladiators.
Yes.
Unexpectedly good game based on McDonald's. But the thing is,
there are three McDonald's platformers and they're all awesome. What's going on there?
I'll tell you what's going on. One of them is made by the guys who made all these games we keep talking about, like Cool Spot.
Dave Perry Returns.
Yeah, I think
the good version of Dave Perry, not the evil version of Dave Perry.
Not that one, no. Saying things that I've found out in the course of my time doing Sonic the Comic, the podcast, and I don't know if they're true. And I'm coming on a more prestigious podcast, and I'm just saying them as if I'm an expert. They might be true, or I might be misremembering. My memory's bad, unless it's of something that happened in 1993, when I'm your man.
Yeah, unless it's something that your geography teacher was impressed by.
Yeah, yeah. That's how I measure. Yeah, if my self-worth was boosted by it, I remember it. Yeah. So I'll remember this if it turns out I was right on Retronauts.
I think at this point we should offer any final thoughts about Zool and then consider wrapping things up to prep for the more interviewee portion of our podcast.
Well, that's going to be seconded, right? So you've had me and then someone who knows what they're on about.
Yes.
That's good.
The plan. I'm by having you on and then I'm having someone come on to debunk everything you've said as being bollocks.
No good, yes.
That's the general plan here. I didn't want to reveal that because I was hoping it would drag you through the mud in the media, but we'll see what happens. Yeah. So final thoughts on Zool, though. Any thoughts about Zool? Do you think Zool has a future? Do you think there's going to be a Zool 2 redimensioned?
It's really good. It's good.
It's Zool, good, isn't it?
There was, here's something we ought to say. There was going to be a Zool 3 and it was going to be 3D. And then it all kind of went to pot and turned into the Ninja Bread Man, which also didn't do very well.
Oh, yes. I forgot about that.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know about it at the time. I was just, I was frankly just grouchy that someone had taken the name the Ninja Bread Man, which I think.
That's too good.
I think I'd made up and was going to use and never got round to or something. I was damn it, that's really good.
That's the worst when that happens, yeah.
It is, isn't it? And for something that was, as I understand it, a big flop, and now I find something of a compromise, when it could have been Zool 3. Mm. No, there's not going to be a Zool 3 because we're way past that point now. Will there be a Zool 2 redimension? Well, I hope so, because I don't think so, but I hope so.
The ending of Zool Redimension sort of implies that they want to do it.
Yes, I know, but the ending of the Power Rangers reboot movie had a green coat and someone said, "Is Tommy here?" And then it ended, and then that was the end of that series. These things take place.
That's true.
And now, nobody come at me with that thing that I know you all want to say about how the end of the Mario movie had a teaser for a sequel. It didn't. That was just a joke. You gotta learn to tell the difference between these things.
I'm not sure anyone was going to come at you about that.
The Super Mario Brothers movie is very good.
Come
at me as hard as you want.
We'll come back to this at some point in the future.
It's a great film.
There is actually, now that we mention it, I say we're wrapping up, but there is something very important I feel like we have to talk about. You know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Zool, there was, I believe, a planned merchandising blitz. Now, there was a marketing blitz because there was a lot of print commercial for this. There was a lot of Zool prop. There was a special level in Zool for the Games Master TV show. It got a lot of press. It did very well review wise. The AntStream interview I mentioned earlier sort of implies that the high review scores it got may have been something to do with the marketing in a slightly cheeky way. Yes. But also, at the part of this merchandising blitz, they released two Zool novels.
They did. Turns out they did. Now, what's really weird about this is that I was proper ear to the ground about this stuff. I've got the Lemmings Adventure Game Book on my shelf right now. I've got the four Martin Adams Sonic the Hedgehog novels, proper novels about Sonic the Hedgehog. I've got them. I didn't know about this, and I was a Zool fan, and I was a Zool fan in 1994 when these books came out. Four?
Yes.
Why? Why was that when the marketing blitz was for a game that came out in 1990?
Well, I think it may have been in order to tie into the release of Zool 2.
Well, we've established that came out in 93.
Yeah, we did. That's true. But then the ports didn't come out till 1994.
Oh, the ports. Yes, of course. I keep forgetting
about
things. The
silly old ports.
Keep forgetting about things that don't matter. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So there was a marketing, but apparently I remember these words coming out of my mouth. I never heard about a Zool watch. So this must have been on my other podcast. I must have found out that there was supposedly Zool merchandise. Oh, yes. It was in the review of Zool in Sonic the Comic, where they said there's even a Zool watch. And I'm like, is there? I never heard of that. Well, I never heard of this. Zool Rules and Cool Zool. Those are the two books. I've got one of them. I haven't been able to find Cool Zool. But Zool Rules, oh, you better believe it. You bet your bippy that when I heard this existed, I went straight onto eBay and I purchased a copy of this book. And that's the only one I've ever found. I haven't found Cool Zool. So if you've got it,
Get in touch, please, or scan it, because I really want to read Cool Zool. I was already aware that Zool Rules. That's the thing. So there's no surprises are going to be coming my way now. But when I discovered that Dave had this book, I felt like imperative that there at least be an extract from it read.
Sure.
Because let's face it, this is going to be great. This is going to be really, really good. And I'm really looking forward to it. Who wrote Zool Rules? Who's the author?
This is written by Ian Edgington, who is a storied comics guy. He's done like X-Force and stuff, I think. I don't actually know, but he's a well-known British comics guy.
Yeah.
This is what I'm here to tell you about, right? This book's quite good.
Oh, wow.
Like, I don't know what you're expecting, but it's not a terrible book. This is a book that's a silly writer having a lot of fun, and that can be good. As you read it, and I've read... Listen, I won't pretend I've read the book, but I've read half the book. I read it about 2 hours before we started recording this.
Okay.
Prior to that, I'd read the first few pages. And from those first few pages, you get the sense of what the whole thing is. What it is it's a guy who is into Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. There are references to Python, Wayne's World. What else does he do? Ren and Stimpy. He's just throwing in silly things that he knows about, and he's just stitching them together into a book. And it's written in a really interesting kind of Hitchhiker but for kids sort of way. So here, then, if you will permit me, is the opening paragraph.
Well, I'm ready.
Actually, there's a little intro. That is just a comedy way of telling you what a book is. But I'm going to read you this. I think you'll find it interesting.
I'm ready. I'm excited. Okay, listeners, Retronauts listeners, this is I hope it's a world exclusive.
There's a war going on, everywhere, all around you, every day. Usually wars are caused by people deciding it's better to hit someone than to talk to them. But this war is different. You won't read about it in the newspapers or see it on the TV news, but it's happening, all right? And if you know what to look for, you'll see the shrapnel. Have you ever put your favorite comic down, only to find a few minutes later it's not where you left it? Or have you been ready to smeg the end-of-level bad guy on your games console?
Oh, God.
When the system crashes and your high score goes down the toilet. Call it bad luck, call it fate, but the more you think about it, the more you realize it's happening all the time, and not just by accident either. What's causing these bad vibes are mystical shockwaves from a war in a place called the Nth Dimension.
Oh, wow.
The main villain behind all of this is a character called Krool, that is K-R-O-O-L. He, or rather it, is an immeasurably powerful and malevolent force on the edge of existence that has watched with envy and waited with impatience from before the beginning of time, probing and testing the walls that keep it on the outside of the universe, trying to force its way in just for an opportunity to spoil your day. He intends to do this by creating a thing called entropy.
Good God.
This will turn everything in the universe back into the energy that it's made from. Krool will then take that energy and fill his face with it all until he's fit to burst. But don't expect a huge invading army to come storming through from the Nth Dimension. Krool's far too sneaky and sly for that. He's slowly worming his way into our universe by taking away all of the fun. If you don't have fun, then you don't really feel like doing much. And if you don't feel like doing much, then entropy sets in, and that's just what Krool wants. His mouth is watering at the thought. If Krool had his way, we'd all be wearing sensible shoes instead of trainers, eating green veggies instead of burgers, and no one would be playing computer games at all. But Krool realizes that total entropy must be accomplished in stages, and on your world, the attacks have just begun. The problem is Krul's not alone in this evil mission. He's being aided by a sinister, shape-changing cube known as Mental Block. Not only can the Blockster alter his own form, but he can twist people's imaginations as well. It's transmogrifying. Obviously, it's meant to be transmogrifying. Not the only spelling mistake I picked out in this. Anyway, transmogrifying the fab and fun things in life into dull and tedious stuff. With an evil being older than the universe waiting to suck you dry, and a maniac shape-changer hopping around in the background looking like a demented washing machine, things might have looked a bit grim, but a hero came forward to fight for everyone's right to have fun and excitement. He's a brave warrior, a party-hardy guy, a dude with mood, a pan-dimensional ninja warlock with a snappy dress sense and his name on the soles of his shoes. He is the one, as per the cover art, he is the one, the only, the fantabulously cosmic Zool. Zool isn't alone either. He's brought some buddies along to help him kick Krul's butt. There's Zuz, the ponytailed princess of power, who's breathtakingly beautiful, devastatingly smart, and who can shoot the eyebrows off a Vigalian bean fly at 1,000 meters. And then there's Zoon, a dog with a split personality, because he's got two heads, one at either end of his body. One end's brainy and smart, the other isn't, but that doesn't stop him from being loyal and brave as he helps his friend save the universe from Krul and his hordes of terminal party poopers. And so the adventure begins.
It's rather good, I thought. I rather enjoyed
it. It's good, isn't it?
It was quite enjoyable.
There's one other bit that I want to read to you, just a sentence, really.
Yeah.
Just because I liked it, and I think you'll like it.
I'm excited about this sentence.
Yes, here we go. The fast food world is where all the nth dimension's hardy party revelers go when they want to get a quick snack. All fun food originally came from there. You've probably heard of a few, like pizza, chips, and burgers. But have you heard of wangers? Have you heard of
wangers? Oh, you're actually asking me if I've heard
of wangers. Yeah. I'm asking you, and I write it down, and I'm going to tell Ian Edgington whether you've heard
of wangers. I haven't heard of wangers.
Okay, so Ian Edgington, if you're listening to this, we haven't heard of wangers. Please illuminate.
Please elucidate. And I think that wangers is an excellent way to bring this this podcast.
And on that wanger.
Yeah. So I think the best thing to do at this point would be to say, Dave, where can people find you on the internet and the things that you do?
Okay. Well, if they just want me to, if they just want alerting to everything I'm doing as it happens, they want to follow me on Twitter at Demon Tomato Dave. I also have a YouTube channel, also Demon Tomato Dave, one word, where I do, all sorts of daft stuff. You'll have to just go and see. There's like video essays, there's a cappella songs, it's all sorts of silly things. My most famous a cappella song is, there's two, Mario Land with lyrics and Ocarina of Time with lyrics, both of which aren't on my channel. They're on Brentel Floss's channel. They're a couple of old medleys I did based on old video game songs, and I'm still quite pleased with those. Go and follow me, Demon Tomato Dave, on Twitter. If you want to hear me rambling on like this, then Sonic the Comic, the podcast, already mentioned the what is now alternative, but me and my co-host Chris Mufili know the true and real and IDST forever history of Sonic the Hedgehog. Is being examined over on Sonic the Comic, the podcast, along with just general 90s nostalgia. We put all the adverts on and that sort of thing. I think you're going to have a nice time. That's very, very produced. I have another podcast called Serious Disney that I do with my friend Jahan Rana Singh, where we talk about the Disney, because, you know, we grew up with a lot of Disney videos, and we talk about all those odd remakes that they're doing now, those weird live-action remakes. But we kind of take them seriously. We sort of give them the time of day and review them properly. So, you know, when they're good, we'll say they are. And when they're bad, you will find a something like 5-hour Beauty and the Beast special that came out last Christmas that was quite a production. That's most of the things, I think. Yeah, Demon Tomato Dave, you'll find me.
And I can assure you, if you follow Dave on Twitter, you will see lots of good things. I guarantee that you will. No, this is true. You will see lots of things that are funny and interesting, and refreshingly few things that are bad and cruel.
Yes.
There's very little negativity, and I respect that. If you want to find what I'm up to, you can follow me on Twitter also at Stupacabra. I won't go into all the detail of all the sort of different podcasts I do. There's the Dillcast, which is reviewing every single Dilbert strip, but mostly it's just an excuse to sort of arse around for an hour. I also do Animania Chat, another podcast called Arsehole Vania, and lots of Retronauts. As for Retronauts itself, if you like Retronauts and you would like to hear more of it, you can support Retronauts by going to our Patreon page, patreon.com/retronauts. And for a mere $5 per month, which, let's face it, is nothing. It's nothing. You'll receive two full-length exclusive episodes per month, and you'll get early access to the weekly episodes on Monday. And you will also receive mini podcasts and writings by Diamond Fight, This Week in Retro, which I might add are very, very good. And I hope that that's everything and I haven't forgotten something, because otherwise Jeremy Parrish will hit me on the head with a hammer.
With his bommy knocker.
Yes. So once again, thank you very much.
Sorry, for anyone who didn't read that particular book in infants class in school, that's not rude and it just means a mace.
Yeah. Boy. Anyway, yes, thank you for listening to this episode of Retronauts. And I know it's been very British. I hope it wasn't too British for you. And,
I hope it was.
Now I have to edit out a third of it.
Yes.
So thanks very much to Dave.
I did warn you.
Hope to see you on here again. And It's always a pleasure. Do take care. And thank you for listening, Retronauts listeners. We love you.
Bye-bye.
Hello, I'm Stuart Gipp. Today I'm talking about Zool Redimensioned from Sumo Digital Academy. And let's see, who am I speaking to? Should we go in alphabetical order?
Hi, I'm Ian Stuart. I'm the founder of originally Gremlin Graphics, that then went on to become Gremlin Group, who were the creators of the Zool games in the early 90s.
Fantastic. And who's with you today?
Cool. And I'm Rob Fennell. I was one of the interns at the Sumo Digital Academy who worked on Zool Redimensioned. And I was one of the developers who helped bring it to life.
That's great. Thanks. That's fantastic. Now, I think I'll start by asking about the Sumo Digital Academy, because I've had the sort of the briefest sort of explanation of it, which does sound, I have to say, it does sound quite fascinating. So if you could go into any sort of more detail, I'd love to know exactly how that came about and how that was for you being part of.
Sure. So the Sumo Digital Academy, so we were part of the first cohort that went through it. We started in September last year, so exactly about a year ago today. And it was made specifically to try and provide kind of additional routes into the games industry. So rather than having to have, you know, some sort of like portfolio or some kind of games or computer science degree, it was kind of open to people from other disciplines. So like previously to this, I used to work in marketing and I did a history degree, which isn't exactly the most typical way into programming. But this was set up to kind of, you know, give us that kind of year to learn and hopefully get something, you know, to show for at the end, which is kind of what Zool was.
Yeah, well, I would say you absolutely have something to show for it, though, because, I mean, not that I'm going to sort of keep talking, obviously, but having spent time with Zool Redimensioned, having played through it, I found it extremely polished, like extremely good. I thought it was great. I mean, I'm predisposed to like games like that anyway, but like, not that I'm putting any sort of aspersions on it, but if someone had told me this had been created from scratch in a year, you know, that's impressive to me personally.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It's obviously the first kind of game that we all worked on, because none of us had any C++ experience coming into this. We might have had a bit of, you know, kind of technical kind of coding experience. But yeah, we literally started from scratch. Like this time last year, we were doing, you know, C++ tutorials. But thankfully, with kind of all the teaching we had, all the kind of contacts across Sumo and, like, you know, former Gremlin people, we were able to, kind of recreate it in a way that I think both retains the kind of original charm of the game, but also opens it up to kind of entirely new audiences who may have never heard of Zool before last week.
Absolutely. I'll ask a bit more about that later. I want to just sort of go back a second, because I do want to focus on the new version, but I've got to ask about the original as well, at least a bit. I suppose, what's the impetus for Zool? Like, where does he did? Was it the character first, or was it just to make a game that was a sort of a mascot game? Or where did Zool come from originally?
I've got to think back now about 29 years.
It was a while ago. Yeah.
it was a culmination of the desire to produce a fast-paced platformer, and just getting some creative heads around what type of character we could use and what sort of world the character would need to be in. And that's where it really started. And took many hours, sat down with artists, programmers, back in the day, we're only small teams, not 20, 30, 40, 100 people. You know, it's a team of four people, and that was about it.
The
character developed as the product developed. And with the art side and a guy called Aid Careless, you know, that's where he was born. And he sort of grew from there. And the world, the nth dimension, grew around the original character.
Is there much in the, with the nth dimension, is there much in the way of that sort of scene setting that, that isn't featured in sort of the game itself? Because the game is, from my sort of experience, is very focused on sort of playing it. It's not so much on sort of the story around it, though it is there at the sort of the fringes. And that's not a criticism. That's what a lot of games were like and still are. But was there sort of a lot more of that that didn't end up in the game, or did that find its way into sort of... Because I know there was a little tie-in novel, at least one, based on the character as well. I wonder if it ended up in there, or if that's something that you had sort of input on.
It was something that... whilst in Zool 2, you met some other characters, like Zune and Zeus. The whole intention was to build a world that we could then open up into sort of many products. That never actually happened. And unfortunately, that's not to say it never will happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to see that go forward from this. And, you know, maybe we can talk about that a little more. But,
But
I think the nth dimension is yet to be explored.
I've got to ask, because this is a very personal question, I think, well, at least from my perspective. I have seen, for some reason, I have it in my head that Zool, the character, is both a sort of an Nindra of the nth dimension and also an ant. And I don't know why I think he's an ant, because I've not seen that backed up in any sort of media. Was that actually a misconception, or is that something that exists entirely in my head?
No, that's a total misconception.
It's not. He's never been an ant. Okay, that's good to know.
Never will be an ant.
Okay.
And ants have six legs.
Yeah, that's true. They do. There's a lot of things that ants can't do that Zool's very capable of. I think that's I don't know why I had that in my head, but I had to finally put that one to rest, because it's
I think this was down to unimaginative reviewers. That
I bet I read it in Sega Pro or something.
Like. Yeah. You would have,
just one quick glance. There he is. That's an ant.
I'm very sensitive about this.
I apologise. I mean, no offence by that. No. Because that's why I want to dispel that once and for all in this arena, while I have the floor to do so. You know, now we can put that out there. Zool officially 100% not an ant. No ant DNA. Is a ninja from the nth dimension, not an ant. That's now black and white. No one can take that away.
Thanks. I'll calm down a little now.
Okay, I'm glad, because I don't want to push this into a kind of angry area, you know. With Zool, the new game, the new version of Zool, was all redimensioned, available on Steam. Very good, by the way. It's based on the Mega Drive version, is it? The console version, rather than the original Amiga version. Is that fair? to say?
Yeah, it's based on the Mega Drive version.
Yeah. And I ask what prompted that choice. Now, again, I don't mean this in a critical sense, but I think the Amiga version is the sort of iconic version because most of sort of Amiga friends that I have do associate the character with the Amiga. Is it simply that the Mega Drive version is sort of a more polished, more sort of... What will you tell me? I shouldn't be telling you that, obviously.
I don't disagree with what you're saying, to be honest. Yeah. Like, when people mention Zool to me, they always say the Amiga one. And so, us releasing the Mega Drive thing has been, commented on. But the reason why we did the Mega Drive version, at least part of it was kind of what we had available. So for the Mega Drive version, we had a complete surviving archive of the code, the actual level editor, and the tools from the original Mega Drive version. So we had those all accessible, which definitely helped speed up some of the kind of, converting the levels to actually something that we could play. Well, for the Amiga version, as far as we know, none of that has been archived. It could be out there, but it could also just be lost to time somewhere. So that just, sped up massively. But also having, played all the different versions, and there are a lot of different versions that all have their own kind of unique quirks.
Yeah.
I probably would say the Mega Drive version might be the most polished one because it's got like an extra world. I think the graphics are slightly more kind of expressive, especially for the enemies and some of the other versions. And also like some of the backgrounds, while they were quite kind of notorious and, iconic with like kind of all the kind of just stuff going on.
Oh yeah, the AGA version of the Amiga game has some insane backgrounds going on.
Oh yeah, it's so mad, like you can barely focus on the actual platform.
It's fantastic,
But I know that's like part of its charm and like, considering do we want to like kind of bring the back a sort of extra, but the Mega Drive version I think just had it all kind of the most polished. So it's kind of a combination of, that sort of like expediency and just the fact that we thought it was the best version to take back.
So I know that the new version Rita mentioned, it's been adapted in sort of several ways to be more sort of, I guess, palatable. That's not to imply the original is unpalatable, but for modern sort of gamer sensibilities, it's definitely an adjustment. And the new version, I think, is a lot more sort of accessible. So I'm sort of wondering what the sort of process behind that was and how the sort of decisions were made that kept the feel of Zool without completely, while changing it to make it a little bit more sort of modernized. So what were the changes that were made and, how were those decisions reached, I guess?
So making decisions was a really kind of, or maybe not difficult, but something that we thought about a lot kind of over the course of the development. Because like, through making the game, we became so aware of like, the kind of the history it has, both of, as like a cult following for people that played on the Amiga, and also like its ties with like the city of Sheffield. Like, we went to the National Video Game Museum as like a kind of a group thing a few weeks ago, and they were selling Zool shirts there just completely unprompted. And so it's like,
oh well.
This game means a lot to, a lot of people and to like, the city that we're in. So we're constantly thinking, we want to change things because, we want to make our own mark in the game. And there's been like loads of modern platformers in the 29 years since it all came out that, we could take aspects from and maybe just, make it play a bit kind of more smooth. But at the same time, we didn't want to make it so that people that play the original would like really notice the differences and it would potentially ruin their experience. So there were some major changes that we made, most notably being the camera being zoomed out. So in the original, it was zoomed in so closely that normally the only way you'd see a hazard is when it hits you and it, takes off a bit of your health bar, which, is not ideal if you're not kind of, used to that sort of punishing gameplay.
I found it changes the way you play the game quite significantly because you can keep much more momentum going now rather than sort of edge forward and firing your sort of... the sort of gumballs. I'm not actually sure what it is that Zool is firing. I thought they were sweets because that's what the licorice all sorts are firing at you in the first level. But I'm not really sure. Is there an official explanation for what it is that he's throwing at his enemies?
I wish there was. Thankfully, the original manual does actually give you quite a lot of like interesting insight to the lore. And so like there's a Beastopedia in the game, which does include some of that, especially like enemy names and kind of some of the enemy bios. But nothing concrete on what he's shooting.
it would be a plasma from the nth dimension, I think.
Oh, there we go. Once again.
Yeah.
See, once again, I feel like by calling them gumballs, I feel like I've done it a disservice.
It does fit with the theme of the first world.
That's what I thought. When they're firing the similar sort of things at you, I thought, well, these must be Swedes, but then why would they hurt you? I guess tooth decay, that's about all I can think of.
Yeah, maybe plasma gunballs then.
That works. Yeah. Best of both worlds, I think. Now, and the boss battles have been almost entirely overhauled, is that right?
I think almost every boss, some of them more than others, have been pretty majorly changed, yeah.
Yeah, because there's some of the multi-phase ones as well, and I've got to be entirely honest with you, I don't think I reached the later bosses when I played it on the Mega Drive or the Master System, which was the version I had as a child. So I can't comment on that, unfortunately, but it seemed like the multi-phase kind of boss battles were something that you generally wouldn't get that much of back in the day, so they seemed very fresh, I thought.
Yeah, there's two kind of ones which have pretty distinct phases, and that was something that kind of just came out of development. So while for like most of the enemies we try to replicate the original behavior as closely as we could, you know, while fixing a few kind of minor issues here and there, the bosses, because they were probably some of the more kind of straightforward parts of the original, so like, you know, it might just be they do the same attack pattern each time, we decided, you know, let's try and make them a tiny bit more interesting. And so it wasn't almost like a competition, but we were like, you know, between each other just trying to see, oh, can we make this boss a bit better, can we add this thing, can we add that thing. And so eventually kind of culminated in that we had, you know, this final boss that has this like really kind of distinct epic final phase. It's like a proper ending to the game. So that was probably the bit that we changed the most, but as far as I can see, people do kind of have enjoyed our new renditions on them, which has made us quite happy.
Yeah, I thought they were really enjoyable. I mean, when I got sent it, I pretty much blitzed through the whole thing in like one sitting in a few hours because I was just really sort of taken with it. I still haven't done the harder mode that's included, though. Could you tell us about that as well?
Yeah, so there's the redimension mode where you can double jump and you don't need to collect any collectibles to finish. And then ultimate ninja mode, you can only jump once and you have to get a certain number, just like in the original.
Yeah.
That was kind of our way of coming up with a compromise between, you know, the way that we kind of wanted to play and the way that's like a lot of people that had played the previous one or like people associated with the original project wanted the game to play.
Yeah.
So like we personally had the double jump in from the start and we thought, you know, oh, this is fantastic to kind of, you know, navigate around the levels, but it definitely does mean that, you know, you can be a bit more sloppy in terms of how you approach it, and it does lose kind of a bit of the feel from the original. So having those both options felt kind of like the best of both worlds.
The harder mode, what was the name of the harder mode again? Master Ninja, was it?
Ultimate Ninja.
Ultimate Ninja, I apologize. The Ultimate Ninja mode, though it still has the kind of quality of life improvements, and it's still, I would say, easier than the original is, but yeah, it does recapture the, it is more accurate with the single jump, but like the falling platforms that don't just immediately vanish like they did in the original game, that sort of thing. So, sort of jumping forward a bit, I don't want to spoil it because we're talking about something really sort of lore heavy here, obviously, as we've established. Can we expect Zool 2 to be redimensioned at any point?
Oh, I haven't quite got that far yet, to be honest.
It's pretty early days. Is the Jaguar source code knocking about somewhere?
I think somebody had bought I think two people bought the Jaguar version.
Oh, yeah, maybe one of those, we can get hold of
maybe
one.
We might be able to crack one of those and use the code. But I think the if I can step back just a while and talk about the Academy.
Absolutely, I'd love to know as much about that as you're willing to tell me.
The guy running the Academy is Jake Hapgood. Jake used to work for me at Gremlin. He then went to work at Sheffield Hallam University, where he's running a degree course for computer games. And he subsequently ended up at creating the Sumo Academy. Now, I've got a long-term professional relationship with Jake, and he's used my IPs over the years at Sheffield Hallam on a number of occasions. I'm an alumni of Sheffield Hallam, so yeah. I'm always happy to help out there. And he's always treated the IPs with respect.
May I ask which other IPs we're talking about? Just I think people would be interested to know. So
yeah, he's done. They did some Zool work a few years back.
I saw there was a plush toy, wasn't there? It was a cuddly toy that came out.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, if we were on video, I could show you one.
I remember seeing them a while back. There was also an Alfred Chicken one, and so all the Amiga players are coming out to play. It was great.
That's right. So Jacob approached me and asked me if I'd be happy if they used Zool within the academy. And because of my relationship with Sumo and the guys there, who I have to take my hat off to, have done an absolutely amazing job. I like to support Sheffield companies. Sumo is probably the closest one to me, other than another company I started after Gremlin. So it was great to allow them to release some younger minds onto the product, just to bring it up to date somewhat. And we've yet to decide as to whether it goes any further with Sumo, or I have to decide whether I take the IP any further outside of Sumo. So there's lots of opportunities going forward, but I must take my hat off to the work that's been done there and the guys that have worked on the project. Done a first-class job. And,
I can only agree with that, again, based on my sort of time with it. It's a game I've been back to quite a few times. With the Academy, is this something that's going to be continuing?
Yes. So the idea was we were kind of almost like the trailblazers for it. So throughout a lot of the year, we didn't entirely know what we were doing. And a lot of the kind of processes were put into place. But going forward, so I think from October, the Academy is launching a new program that's a kind of diversity internship that is meant to be helping people from underrepresented backgrounds kind of get their first taste.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
Which is awesome. I think it's a 3-month internship. But then after then in January, the next cohort, which will be a full-on apprenticeship, which Jake's tireless work in getting this game programming apprenticeship approved through all the systems, I think finally went through a few months ago. So that's starting in January, and I think it's going to be a year to 2 years process with the students coming through, same as us. And I think the idea is that they'll end up taking up a similar project to what we did. So whether that, that it could be Zool 2, it could be something entirely different. It'd just be speculation at this point. But I'd hope that they would have their own kind of project to work on and be able to release something at the end of it.
Now, so where are people coming from to sort of enter this sort of program? Is this something anyone can better question. How did you get involved in it? Like, how did it start for you?
So they just listed it as kind of, a listing on a job website.
Yeah, so it's just,
everyone.
Yeah.
And I think, the idea is that kind of anyone, as long as I don't even think you really need any experience, you obviously need some sort of, interest in wanting to pursue, because, it's a year commitment. Outside of that, they're not really looking for anything. And so all of us, while we were all graduates, we all had very kind of disparate degrees. But we had no experience with C++ before, and that's totally fine. So I think really anyone, I think the only people that maybe it isn't best suited for is people that have literally gone through specific, game focused courses, because they already probably do have the experience in the portfolio to have a stab at getting a sort of junior role. But otherwise anyone.
How many were there on the team overall this time?
So there was 5 of us.
Oh wow.
Total.
Yeah.
So
back to old school, back to sort of in a way like the original would have been developed, although it may have been even fewer. I can't remember the exact number it was given.
I think the original was only 2 people, at least for the kind of ports, and they did it in a really short space of time as well, which is just unbelievable to hear that. We'd spend a year toiling away over this, but there was only 5 of us, and it was really nice in the end, because we had a really kind of tight-knit group and kind of all learning from each other and all in the kind of same position, despite being different ages, having different experiences and everything. So
Ian, if I could ask you, how does that compare with your experience working on the original game? What sort of time frames were you working with? What sort of pressure were you under with that?
Very different times, obviously.
Yeah.
Very different tool sets available to you. But we were lucky that the people that Gremlin attracted initially were both programmers and real game enthusiasts. And George Allen, who was the main coder on the product, is still making games today. Yeah, it's in fact, I think he's got a release coming up fairly shortly, which has got a little feature of Zool in it. So,
now I have to know, unless you can't tell me if it's under NDA or something.
Let me check just so as I wouldn't want to say anything that was,
Of course, absolutely. Yeah,
yeah. So the time that we allowed on a product, or you know, it was really how long is a piece of string? You know, the product was completed when we decided how many levels it would satisfy the audience and how well the game was playing.
Yeah.
The processes that the games were put through at that time were nowhere near as rigorous as they are nowadays.
No. I mean, well, something I find personally interesting about the old Amiga Zool, because I went back to that recently prior to this sort of discussion, I was quite fascinated how it doesn't have the sort of platform game conventions that sprang up even quite quickly. Like even small things like the fact that the game starts with you on a slope at an angle is really unusual for a platform game. So it just feels like it's just very sort of rich with ideas, which I did appreciate. A lot of Amiga stuff felt like that at the time, I found.
Yeah, like, I think we were probably leaning on what was happening on the Sega Mega Drive at the time and endeavouring to give a similar experience to the Amiga users.
Was that was it always planned for consoles, or was it Amiga first, and then that sort of came about later? And if so,
no, it was Amiga first.
Yeah, and how did that come? Because it was on more or less. It felt like it was on more or less everything. It was on Master Systems, Super Nintendo, Mega Drive, probably older computers as well.
Yeah, the what used to happen generally back in the day, because porting wasn't as quick as it is nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, you were working on 6502, Z80, blah, blah. You know, it was, it depending on the lead platform, depending on how successful the product was going to be, then you would then make a decision as to whether it was worth doing those conversions or not.
Yeah.
And with Zool, it was definitely worth it.
Yeah, and then for the console versions, was the Mega Drive version then sort of become the new lead version, so to speak?
No, I don't think it ever did.
Okay. No,
the Amiga was, because it got taken up by Commodore and packaged with hardware, etc. It became quite substantially the lead version.
Yeah, of course, yeah. It's a very, I remember it very fondly. That a very iconic sort of cover art on the box with Zool like kicking his way through like the sort of jet black kind of void. I remember the double page spread advertisements in magazines like Sega Power. Look, this is coming to everything. Like, that was felt like a big marketing sort of blitz. And of course, there was the whole endorsement via Chupa Chups Lollipops as well. Would it be too trite to ask about that and how that came about?
I struggle to remember exactly what happened.
Yeah,
but we just needed some collectibles in the game, and one of our marketing people obviously ate a lot of Chupa Chups. So we approached the company that I think it was a Spanish company that had Chupa Chups at the time, or Chupa Chups, as they called them.
Yeah, does sound a bit Spanish.
Yeah, yeah. It was never pronounced Chupa Chups. That's a typical English version of a word that could sound much better.
So
Chupa Chups was pretty popular, and they were doing lots of promotions in the UK. You get the stands by the counters, etc. And it was a good marriage as far as that was concerned. And
The first level being based around sort of sweets confectionery, that really sort of sold the Chupa Chups thing. Was the sweets level there first, or was that entirely inspired by the?
No, I think the sweets level would have been first.
Ah, yeah, okay, good. That's good to know. It's like a chicken and egg scenario in a way.
Yeah,
yeah, and of course that's not that wasn't a entirely unusual thing for sort of British platform games, because there was things like Pushover that was sponsored by Quavers, and James Pond was sponsored by Penguin Biscuits, of all things. Yeah, Super Frog was LucasAid. There's a lot of that around back in the
Amiga. Yeah, it was. I'm trying to think about it now. We had a Chewitz sponsor as well at some stage. That was in a sort of. It was basically a rip-off of a Rampage game.
Oh, the monster from the advert back in the day. I remember that. Yeah. The big Chewitz lizards. I remember that now. Yeah. That's didn't right, know he had his own game. This is what makes British games so great.
We had the game and then we added the Chewitz to it.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. But it was the early days of that type of promotion. And, and I have to say that the Chewitz people, I can't remember the name of the company that produced them, but that we got so many lollipops. Honestly. I swear there's probably boxes of them still laying about somewhere.
And I'm sick of the sight of them.
Yeah, I wish I'd taken some shares in some of the major dental companies.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, yeah.
Having said that, the cola lollipop was the best one.
Oh yeah, I can only agree with that, based solely on the sound. I mean, it just sounds excellent to me, the cola lollipop. But I mean, they stuck around for Zool too. They were there, all present and correct there as well. So, you know, good for them. They knew they were loyal.
They were loyal, but they things have moved on, and they weren't particularly interested in being included in Redimensions. So
that's a shame.
That one's put to bed, never to be seen again in the Zool game.
Going back to Redimensioned, Rob, could you tell us about the sort of the new features, like the new sort of incentives? Because, of course, the original version was a more straightforward, you know, get all the items, get to the end. But in this, there have been like sort of new goals and achievements added. Could you tell us about those at all?
Yeah, so just we thought, like, you know, these levels and these worlds were actually like a lot more interesting than I think the original game maybe gave them credit for. And so there was plenty of room to both, you know, put some like big hidden collectibles around that made it more of like, you know, a kind of secret finding sort of puzzle platformer type thing. Yeah. But then also have some emphasis on the speedrunning thing. So quite a few of us on the team are quite interested in, like, you know, kind of speedrunning games and like kind of the community around that. And games like Celeste and stuff have like, a big inspiration for kind of, how we wanted to turn Zool into something slightly more modern. So we added the kind of speedrun times, we added the collectibles, we added the like, don't die in a level when you get a badge award things. We thought they added just something else for, like, you know, other whatever you want to do in a game really is kind of there for you.
I noticed that there was an achievement. I'm not 100% sure this is still in the game, but I noticed there was an achievement for beating one of the developer times or something along those lines. And I couldn't find the developer times. So I wondered if there is a way to display them or if it's just a matter of practicing and practicing and practicing.
Yeah, so it is just a matter of practicing. So they were all, Owen, who is the lead programmer and by far the best at the game, he could really zip through some of the levels. It really puts all to shame. But basically his best times were put in as kind of like, they weren't like, we never put like you had to get under this time, but it was meant to be, you know, if you were quick enough, then you your time went gold and you got an achievement for it. This is like kind of a secret thing to do.
That's correct, because I was trying to get the one on the first level because I was doing what I thought were flawless runs and I apparently wasn't even close. But then I did discover a pro strategy, which is that if you slide down the hills, you can get your top speed up quite a lot.
There's something else where spin attack that in the original you could basically just hold down a spin attack and jump into enemies and the game became almost trivial. We changed it into some more of like a kind of a ground pounds type move, but if you do that from enough of a height and then you you jump, you then kind of get a burst of speed, so you can do it. So you can kind of chain these spin attacks together and keep your momentum going and beat the first level in I think around 18 seconds or something ridiculous like that.
Strats. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, which like, yeah, we kind of hope that if there is a speedrun community around that, they'll start using some of these. And I think some streamers have started to discover some of the secrets we added in. But,
Can you tell us about any of those other secrets, or are they to remain hidden away? I have to say, I did find a couple of secret levels in the game when I played through it.
Yeah, so the original secret levels from the game, which were these kind of this side-scrolling shooter type thing, they had some secret warps in the original Mega Drive ones, but they were like completely impossible to find without having some sort of guide. It was like, you know, jump into this very specific ceiling thing, and you literally could never find them. And we only found them because one of the developers who originally worked on it gave us documentation that told us this is where the secrets are. So we added in, we basically changed their locations so you can find them around the game. And what was really cool was two other interns who joined us quite late, who are slightly more kind of early on in their process, Bradley and Atika, they basically did the side-scrolling levels entirely by themselves and programmed them into the game. So like, that's fantastic to be able to give them the credit on
it. Absolutely.
And they're quite well hidden, but you should be able to find them if you poke around.
How many are there in the game? Is there one per world? Or
So there's four.
There's four. Okay, I found half of them then.
Yeah,
I found the one with the piano, which has the hint in the level, which I won't ruin. And I found one other, which I forget. I think it was under the music level. You can double back under the music level when you've beaten the boss, and there's a warp down there. But I almost immediately died, so I didn't get to finish the one.
Yeah, I think that's a toy one. But yeah, there's worlds I can reveal are the tool world and the sand world. They're in there somewhere. So good luck
finding
them.
Tool world and the sand world. I'm going to find them. You can bet I'm going to find them. I want to ask about one incredibly weird specific thing that caught my interest, if that's okay. And this is really weirdly specific, so I apologize. At the end of World 1, once you beat the big bee boss, there's a single collectible above the exit that you have to climb up and get, and then you get an achievement for it. And I was wondering what the story is with that collectible.
I am so glad you asked that, actually. Yeah. So if you actually look in the Beastopedia, this collectible had its own entry.
Okay.
That was, quite a funny inclusion. So in the original level codes, like the level maps from the original game, that collectible was there for some reason, and we've absolutely no idea why. And we asked George Allen, who was the programmer on the original, and he didn't know either. So it's just there. Yeah, we thought, like, why not, you know, reward players' curiosity by giving an achievement for it.
See, I love stuff like that. It just shows, just kind of goes above and beyond. It's like, not only it's been recreated, but also the idiosyncrasies have been acknowledged in a way that's not doesn't depreciate the game. It's just a fun thing. But I'm glad to have. I'm glad that that's been resolved now. Although, of course, if it was in the Beastopedia and I missed it, I do apologize.
There were some other kind of small things where we found in the actual kind of like object descriptions for all the enemies in the game. Some of them had really interesting names. So there's this kind of this red character who's in the tool world, who he splits into two, just fairly kind of innocuous enemy. He was called Chris. We don't know why he's called Chris, but he's given a name. I think it's the only one, which is cool. And then the boss of the fair world, which is this absolutely terrifying kind of clown type thing, is known as Gaffer. So we just affectionately called the whole project Gaffer for the majority of the project, which is quite fun. But yeah, it was nice kind of throwing some recognition on those kind of really, really obscure things that probably no one noticed, but meant a lot to us as we were developing it.
Are there any other sort of Easter eggs in the game I could ask about, or have we covered that sort of pretty thoroughly now?
I think that's probably most of them. There are some of the secrets and some of the places of the big collectibles that kind of mirror certain secrets in the original. Like, there might have been a random kind of gap in the levels that like was maybe intended as a secret, but never actually was made to do anything. And we like repurpose that as somewhere that, you know, the secret could hide. So we did try to, kind of bring those kind of things to life, but check the Beastopedia. I'm going to plug it as much as I can.
I will say now, I've got to mention this because, again, no one, I haven't been doing Retronauts as a presenter for that long, and no one but me is ever going to bring this stuff up. There's this minutiae, because I spent a fair amount of my playthrough and then a second and third time through trying to find the Games Master secret room. Because back in the day, there was definitely a secret room dedicated to Games Master, either the TV show or the magazine. And I realize now that was probably in the AGA version the whole time, and I wasted my time looking for it. But if anyone knows where the Games Master secret room is, I would really love to have that information back in my life.
Sadly, that's not something we brought into this version. There are a few things from that we really wanted to, like on the toy world in the original, there was like a kind of an arcade cabinet type thing that you could control and you could play within Zool. Yeah. But that actually wasn't in the original Mega Drive one. And even though we had this kind of like Etch-a-Sketch arcade thingy, we just didn't really have the time or like, you know, the resources available to bring it to life, which was a shame. And like, these other secrets from these other games, we did try and acknowledge them in certain places, but we only had kind of so much time and so many resources to.
I mean, I think considering the time that it was done in, it's pretty full-featured, pretty impressive project. I liked that you had, if you could tell us about the accessibility options, that would be great, because that was another feature I appreciated.
Yeah, that was something that from early on in the project, we were really determined to get in like as much kind of accessibility features as we can, inspired by, like in Celeste, how, you can pick on any of these options to beat the game, like no matter kind of, how you want to play it. So yeah, from the start, we wanted to put in stuff that just made it easier. So you can play it through Invincible if you wanted to, and it'd be a cakewalk, or you could have infinite jumps. And yeah, we just thought like that would be more accessible, really. And there were some other things that I think we're looking at that may or may not go in, such as like ways to adjust the contrast that things are easier to see. Really kind of as much as we can do to kind of support it for as many
in a future patch. Now, I'm conscious of time. There's a couple of other things I'll bring up quickly. Now, what was it? Brilliantly, I've immediately forgot what it was. Right, I'll come back to that. Ian, we talked very briefly about, well, it's been alluded to or mentioned at least briefly, the chance of possibly a new Zool game, not necessarily Zool 2, but something new featuring the character. Is that something that's sort of on the horizon or just a sort of twinkle in the eye, or is it something you're interested in producing? Or
A bit of all three, really. The part of the process we're going through now with the work that the Academy have done is to really identify whether there's an appetite for the character and games featuring their character out in the marketplace. And I think we probably need just a little while longer to assess the reaction. And I have to say, the actual reaction has been fantastic. Very, very pleased with that.
Yeah.
But as to whether that transferred into sales then, which is obviously the important thing, so we can employ more of these graduates, et cetera. I say we, I'm talking about Suma. So you may have to wait a little while until you hear anything definitive as far as that's concerned.
I'll urge listeners to go and buy it because it's tremendous. I remember the other question I wanted to ask now. What are the odds, realistically, that this thing is going to hit any other platforms, like the Nintendo Switch, for example? Is that remotely possible?
I couldn't possibly say.
Okay.
Well, at least on the Academy's end, maybe that could be a future project for other cohorts going through, porting it to other systems. I mean, we'd love to get it on Switch, obviously.
It would be a perfect fit, yeah.
Yeah, but I think it's just totally down to what the Academy decides to do in the future. If Studio want to do it themselves, of course, but yeah.
And that's why I couldn't possibly say.
Okay. That wasn't just being coy. You literally couldn't possibly say.
No. I was just teasing there a little.
That's okay.
And just a call out for George Allen here. The name of his new game coming out is called Grim Earth.
Pretty cool name.
So watch out for that one.
I will, especially if Zool is somehow involved.
There you go.
I will keep an eye out for that, Grim Earth. So that's Zool Redimensioned and Grim Earth. Mostly Zool Redimensioned today, which we've discussed in reasonable detail. I think that's a good place to leave it for the time being. But I would like to ask both of you, where can our listeners find out more about you, or upcoming projects, or what you're up to in general? If you want listeners to come and find you doing those things?
Well, the Academy, as far as that's concerned, if anyone's interested, they should obviously contact Suma and Jake Hapgood. As far as I'm concerned, upcoming projects, I didn't answer fully your question earlier about is there anything else going on. I do have a Hogs of War game that again started with some students. It's basically Hogs of War reheated.
Oh, fantastic.
Which I'm working on with a number of people that came through the university. And that's probably 6 months away, but I'm enjoying the process, so that's good.
Now I desperately want to ask you about Rick Mail, but I think we're out of time for that. Perhaps later.
For another day.
Yeah, perhaps another time. Well, that's fantastic. And Rob, how about you? Where can people find out about you or what you're up to?
So as Ian said, check the Academy website for any updates on that. And definitely, if anyone's interested, apply for the next cohort, which I think applications will open towards the end of this year to start in January. But for me personally, I mean, you can follow me on Twitter. I just started a working out, which is RobCF3, or just search Rob Fennell on Twitter and you'll find it. I'm delighted to say, like, kind of on behalf of all the other interns, we all started permanent jobs at SEMO working on some fancy projects today.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. It's been really cool seeing us all kind of make that step forward. But I'm sure we'll be able to keep you updated on any future things which we make.
That's grand. That's fantastic. This has all been grand. It's a really pleasure to talk to both of you. And I urge everyone to keep an eye out for Zulu Dimension, because it really is very good. And keep an eye out on SEMO Digital Academy as well. And thanks very much for coming to Retronauts. Hopefully we'll talk again at some point.
Thank you, Stuart. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Stuart.